So tonight, our speaker is Dr. Paul O.
Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. And I'm here to talk about my two favorite topics, Alcoholics Anonymous and me. We have a topic discussion group that I go to regularly, and the speaker names the topic. And this one night, they named the topic as being the bondage of self. And I thought, well, that's about the dumbest topic I've ever heard. You won't get anybody to volunteer to talk about that. But as the meeting went on, I got a lot of good thoughts about that. She didn't call on me. But you know, I came to the conclusion that I am indeed the most interesting person I know. I really, really have had an interest. I'm just fascinated with the things that I have done, the things I didn't do, the things I wish I hadn't done, things I wish I had done, things I might do, things I wish I would do, things I hope I don't do, things I hope I do do. And I really find me just a fascinating topic. I just could go on and on. It's like the fellow said at the morning meeting. He says, I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. But to show that I'm not completely self-obsessed, there are two people that asked to be mentioned. One is Scott Redmond, wanted you to know that he knows me. And the other one was Ira. Where's Ira? Raise your hand. There's Ira. I wondered that Ira thought it would be nice if I'd let you all know that he's here searching for a meaningful relationship. Look from where you are, but from where I looked at standing, it looked like it was all the women that were applauding right now. So this should work out well. Anyhow, you know, I think this is a good time to bring it up. It's one of my private peeves that on a thing like this, like cruises and vacations, on the day we leave, everybody's running around hugging each other and exchanging phone numbers and addresses and being real friendly. And it just seems like it's ridiculous to wait until we're leaving to do all that to get friendly. It seems like it ought to start at the beginning. You're standing there shaking your head. You don't know what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest that we all stand up and meet at least three other people that you don't know and do that right now. That's more important than anything I have to say. Well, you did that very well. As I find out, that sort of thing is easier to start than it is to stop. I don't know. I'll just go on talking anyway. You go on talking, I'll go on talking. We'll both have a good time. Yeah. You know, here I am traveling around the country talking on alcoholism. I've always wanted to do that. I don't particularly like to travel. It's not that I'm afraid, it's just that it's, I don't like making plane connections and all that stuff, so I'd rather not travel. But I've always been willing to travel to Sweden or Norway or wherever it is. Wherever it is that you go to get the Nobel Prize in medicine. I always wanted to get the Nobel Prize for having discovered the how to diagnose and treat some real serious medical disease. And I was willing to, I don't like to travel, but I was willing to go to wherever it is where the king gives you the Nobel Prize in order to accept. I thought the least, if they're going to give it to me, the least I could do is go there to accept it. But when I got there, I was going to give all the credit to God because I figured that he knows the answer. All he had to do was tell me how to cure some important medical disease, and I would get the Nobel Prize, and I'd give all the credit to him, which was where he'd earned it. And I was going to make God famous, but his job was to make me famous first. And he already knows this stuff. All he had to do was tell me, and I could tell them. And I thought it was a real bargain, but he never bought it. He not only didn't make me famous, he made me anonymous. So here I am sharing all my great knowledge with you. And this is a disease. It's what we have is a medical problem, a serious medical problem, spiritual answer, but it's a medical problem. And you may think we're here having fun. A lot of people may think we're having fun. Indeed, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves that we don't have fun. But we are treating our disease. This is part of our treatment of our disease. We're a bunch of sick people, and we're here getting well, by God. And it's too bad the insurance companies don't agree with me. But we can work on that, and the main thing is to get well. So we're here to get well of our disease. And I've studied many medical diseases over there. I've been around medicine and pharmacy since I was 4 years old when my father bought a drugstore. And then I later became a pharmacist and then went to medical school. And I've studied a lot of medical textbooks. But our book is the only medical text I've ever studied where part of the recovery is that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Middle of page 132, really the very middle. I'm sure if you haven't checked it out, you will after I tell you. There are 16 lines above it and 16 lines below it, and two extraneous words before it and two extraneous words after it. And in the very, very middle of page 132, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Part of our program. It's after we do all the 12 steps, but before the letters, but we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And if you're not enjoying life, you're not doing it right. And that's part of our being here. And an awful lot of that, I find, has to do with attitude. I came into the program knowing that naturally your attitude is a reflection of what's going on in your life. You'd feel like I did too if you had my problems. You'd feel like I do if you had my wife, if my this, my that. My attitude was a reflection of my life. And I knew that was the way it was supposed to be. I get to the program and they tell me things like AA stands for altered attitudes. And I find that I had it completely reversed. That my attitude, my life is a reflection of my attitude far more than my attitude is a reflection of my life. My attitude is my choice. It's my choice. As somebody said, and I agree with him, forget his name, but doesn't matter. He said that life is 90% attitude and only 10% reality. And so I'm convinced that I was wrong. And that's why my attitude is my responsibility. And that's the way with this here. Think of all the trouble that Guy and Steve and Annette and Club Med and God himself have gone to the trouble they've gone to bring this all together for us here today. To have all this this week. And the trouble they've gone to. And yet all they've done is worth nothing if we have a rotten attitude. Can't have a good day, a good week, with a rotten attitude. And you can't have a bad day, a bad week, with a good attitude. You can't have it. I reversed it, but you'll figure it out after we think about it. Yeah. The two go together. So anyway, it's our responsibility. And the surer I was about the fact that naturally attitude is a reflection of life, I was completely wrong. Just like my sponsor used to say, the surer you are, the wronger you can be. I never knew what he was talking about. But this morning, I don't know about you, but I took a very cold shower because I knew that red means hot water and blue means cold water. Not here. If you're a dummy like I am and took a cold shower today, blue means hot, red means cold. I found that out the hard way. I was speaking to my sponsor. His favorite comment was, he didn't talk as much as to say, the surer you are, the wronger you can be. He was more likely to say things in one word. Like, I would tell him my deepest, darkest problems. And his answer would be, whatever. And I've never been able to figure out, what do you do with whatever? Yeah. If he was real talkative, he might say, well, whatever. Yeah. I remember when I first got sober, and I was still, Max had been driving me to drink for 28 years, and here I am now, I'm not able to drink, and she's still acting like she was, and I thought, somebody needs to know what it is that I'm having to put up with and not drink. I mean, the least I can do is share this with somebody that I can't drink. And let me tell you what she did now. And I thought, that's what a sponsor is for, somebody to whine to. And I would call him up and tell him what she had done or failed to do. And one of my sad stories, and I called him up this one day, and I don't know whether he was just in a bad mood or I called him at the wrong time or what it was, but I'd hardly even gotten started on what she had done, and he interrupted me. And he said, why don't you put it out of your mind a couple of days and see what happens? And I said, Jack, a couple of days, I'll forget all about it. Yeah. And I found out you can't, that's the way with problems. You can't ignore your problems. I mean, you have to give them your full attention. You have to let other things slide. Have you ever had a problem that was such a work of art that you couldn't even go to a meeting that night? This is a meeting tonight. You're going to be there? Oh, no, I can't stay. I got to work on this problem. You know, if you waste time going to that meeting, you may come back and find that problem is welded down to where you can't even bring it back. And problems are very fickle. I mean, if you don't give them the attention they demand, they'll go find somebody who will. I mean, it's just... You have to work on your problems. Anyhow, another thing too is this. I noticed that this keeps tickling my wrist. Some of you may not be accustomed to these bracelets. I mean, this one is like most of them. They're unbreakable. I was talking to Tom, on the bus coming over. They were talking about putting them on. They were putting them on there. We were talking about. Now, Tom and I, and the people who are used to these, are the real alcoholics. I came to my first AA meetings with one of these unbreakable things on it, and had my name on it, in case I forgot who I was. And it had the name of the local nut ward, in case I was lost and you had to bring me home. And it was embarrassing to wear that thing to meetings. Especially, it was embarrassing to go to AA anyhow. God knows somebody might see you there. And, it was sad enough that I was in the nut ward because I was there by mistake. I suppose if you belonged there, it'd be all right. But I, yourself, it was embarrassing, I'll tell you. I was in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And the main waiting room, they wanted you to get out of bed, get out of bed, ring the bell, and get out of bed. Yeah? And they wanted you to go sit in the lobby or wherever it is. And there was a big glass windows there. And on the other side of the glass windows, outside, was the main walkway into the front door of the hospital. And I could just visualize my patients walking by and looking, oh, there's my friendly neighborhood doctor in the nut ward. You know? It's embarrassing to sit there, and the reason I didn't belong there, I had a brain tumor, and had a brain tumor and they missed it. They not only missed it, they wanted me, they were fascinated with this, with occupational therapy. They wanted me to make leather belts. And, you know, it would be okay if it was just something they did and it was there if you wanted it. But it wasn't like that at all. It was part of the program. And you couldn't get out unless you made a leather belt or ashtray or something useful. I bet if they had a Senate investigation of that and they had checked it, I bet they'd find people that have been there for years and they won't let them out until they make a leather belt or something. They were really fanatics about this thing. And I told them. They tried to tell me that it would even improve the quality of my life to learn how to make leather belts. I told them, I said, I have a whole wall full of certificates and licenses and diplomas and stuff to prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence. And I don't see how making leather belts would improve my life in any way. And I didn't understand the philosophy. And besides, I didn't understand the instructions. That wasn't my fault. That was the fault of that dumb occupational therapist. I've always known, if you don't understand a thing well enough, she explains to me so I understand it, then you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. She'd explained to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her another time. I went back to my cell, by God, I wasn't going to do that. In fact, I remember when I've been to all kinds of AA functions since then. I've been to conventions and roundups and seminars and H&I stuff. I want all the AA experiences I can get. I want them all. And yet I've never been to any one of them that had an occupational therapy booth. I know I went to that AA meeting, a couple of them, and I went back there and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. Really beautiful. I wish I had brought them. I love those moccasins. I used to wear them every chance I got, and not only was the workmanship good, but the quality was good. Those things lasted 7 years. It took 7 years before they wore out to the point where I couldn't wear them and I couldn't repair them anymore. And for my 7th AA birthday, my dear Al-Anon wife had my moccasins bronzed. And I love my bronze moccasins. I just love them. Even though they're not nearly as comfortable anymore. Speaking of Max, she's sitting there looking very innocent. But the 2nd of last month, this is still January, 2nd of last month, Max and I celebrated our 57th wedding anniversary. You are nowhere near as impressed as I am. And I want you to know that for our wedding anniversary, I told her that my gift to her was that I was going to make our 58th year the best year of our marriage to the very best of my ability. And every day since then, I have reminded her as to how damn lucky she is. And I've been working on that, and I've been real good to her. She's never had it so good. I've made her what she is today. Grateful member of Al-Anon. As they say, if it weren't for me, she wouldn't even have Al-Anon program. And she likes to remind me, if it weren't for me, she wouldn't need Al-Anon program. And so anyhow, here we are, and having all this fun and getting well of our program, of our disease. And there I was sitting in the nut ward in the beginning. And I remember when Frank came to see me. In fact, I remember sitting there at the nut ward commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes and misdiagnoses and bad medical management and the things that had gone wrong, that a nice guy like me was in a place like that. When this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't see that our problems were strictly marital, walked up behind me and wanted to know if I'd be willing to talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God Almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? Yeah. But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on the nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And that's how Frank came running into the room, yelling at the top of his voice, "My name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic, ha 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 ha." And I was embarrassed for him. Here he is meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he could say about himself is that he's an alcoholic. And in a loud voice, my God, he was talking loud about us drunks, us alcoholics, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? And these people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we just leave it at that? You know? Finally, and I don't remember anything he said, but I know he finally ended up saying, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to meet you. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it, but I'll go." And went to a couple of meetings, and the meetings had I don't remember them, but they had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. He really was now suspiciously interested in my case. He wanted to know, what's this about book? What's this about steps? How many steps are there? What other kind of meetings do they have? How often do they have meetings? How often are you going to go to the meetings? All these questions. I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to go to get him sober and get enough brownie points to get discharged. And I had no intentions of going back to AA when I got discharged from the hospital. Why would I? I wasn't an alcoholic. But Max liked the meetings. Of course, once I found out she liked the meetings and I could use that against her, if she didn't behave right, I decided I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. I guess they said that once too often, and she couldn't do that. We lived in Anaheim, went to meetings in Laguna Beach, so we wouldn't run into anybody we knew, and she couldn't drive that far in the car, she couldn't drive the freeway, but she did it anyhow. She'd go off and go to the meeting by herself. I don't know if you ever tried that. You ever tried sitting at home on a Saturday night, drinking, while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? I found it very boring. I had to go back to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. Found out they laugh at anything. And it was amazing. It was embarrassing, the things they laughed about. And it took me 7 months of sitting there trying to figure out what they were laughing about. And one night I found myself laughing with them. And I haven't had a drink since. And to me, the laughter has been very much, very therapeutic, very much a spiritual part of the program. In fact, I'm convinced that my higher power laughs anytime he hears alcoholics or Al-Anons laugh, even if he doesn't understand the joke. It's a part of the program. And so I haven't had a drink since then. But that's how I got my alcoholism. That's how I became convinced that it's a contagious disease. Yeah. Yourself. I mean, you catch it from other alcoholics. In fact, I'll bet that here, I'll bet there are non-alcoholics here who don't realize what a dangerous spot you're in. This is a very contagious, addicting disease. I mean, you have to be very careful what you listen to. And if you hear something and you think, "I didn't do that, but I did, I felt like that when I did what I did," you suppose I might be in a boom, just like that, you're an alcoholic. And once you got it, it's too late. It's over. You won't even get any sympathy here. You turn to the person next to you and say, "You know, I think I might be an alcoholic." They say, "Well, we got another one. Ha, ha, ha. Raise your hand. Put your hand up." They'd love to infect you. That's what happened to me. And when I got my alcoholism, I was very mild. Very mild alcoholic. Just barely, almost a non-alcoholic. But once I became an alcoholic, then I had to go to meetings in order to keep from drinking, because I thought, you know, I came to AA with a sense of failure in so many aspects of my life. I mean, you have to be a failure to go to the bottom of the social barrel and start attending AA meetings, for God's sake. And here I am, a sense of failure at the bottom of the barrel. I thought, I've got to at least succeed in this. And so I want to be a successful member of AA. Now, over the years, I've changed my opinion at different times as to what a successful member of AA is like, but essentially, I don't know any successful members who drink. And in fact, I decided I wouldn't drink. But what happened is I had to keep going to meetings in order to not drink. And I went to meetings long enough to find out that if I want to not drink, I've got to work the steps. I've seen people who can stay sober without the steps. They stay sober on the meetings, just on the fellowship. I've seen them have beautiful, beautiful sobriety with just the steps. I mean, with the meetings. Beautiful, right up to the day they get drunk. I find out that I have to work the steps if I want to stay sober. Then I found out that I've seen people who work this, go to meetings until they find out they have to work the steps. They work the steps and they have such beautiful sobriety they don't need the meetings anymore. And they end up getting drunk after 5, 15, 20, 30 years. So I find out that from what I've observed is I've got to go to meetings and work the steps and keep doing both. In fact, even at this time, I'm in the process of redoing the steps according to the pamphlet that I've got. And the Saturday before last, I took my fifth step again, because that's the way I do it. About every, not by plan, but about every 5 years, I redo all the steps. And each time I've done that, I've moved to a new plateau in my sobriety. And I've seen a lot of people in the program been sober 5 years, 10 years or more, feel like the program just isn't doing it for them anymore. Just their sponsors moved away, or they moved away, and they're not getting to as many meetings, and the meetings aren't as interesting, and no, they're not sponsoring anybody, and they're drifting away from the program. And they wonder if they shouldn't do this or that, or they've gone to a counselor, or the counselor thinks they need an antidepressant or something like that. And I say, why don't you redo all the steps and see what happens? And I've had a lot of them. Redo the steps, start over at the beginning, and reach that new plateau and find that the life still is, there still is life after sobriety. In fact, it seems to me that in AA, what I see is that people are divided into two groups. Either those who want to do enough to stay dry, and that's it. Don't want to get too involved. That's the way I was in the beginning, didn't we? But I told Max, let's not get carried away with this thing. Let's not get too involved. I want just enough. But in the other half are people who want everything they can get. Everything they can get out of this program. And that's where I am today. I want everything I can get out of this program. I know I can't get it all. There's more here than I can possibly get. There's more here than anybody can possibly get. You just can't. That's why I've been living so long, because I want all more and more of this stuff, and I want to get all of it in that I can. And so I just want to get it all, and I want to get as much as I can. I can't get it all. The reason I'm stammering around up here is that I'm having a problem. I may be talking to you, but I'm having a much more intense conversation with the people in my head. They are giving me a little bit of a problem. I'm trying to talk in a somewhat of a straight line, and that's okay, except that the people in my head, and one of them will say, well, why don't you talk about this? And before I can do anything about it, one over here will say, no, I'm talking about this, I'm talking about this. And then the third will say, no, don't talk about this, let's talk about this. And they get the fighting back and forth among themselves about what I ought to be talking about, and it's very distracting for me to try. And I think to myself, why don't you shut up there? And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. it's that old business. It's not what happens out there. It's not what reality is. It's who I listen to up here who is talking about what happens out there. That's the way with Max. It isn't what Max does that determines whether we have a happy relationship. It's who I listen to in my head who is interpreting about what she does. And there are people up there on both sides, or more than two sides, of every question. And they love to debate these things. And that's okay, except my life is determined by who I listen to. Even like this business with Max, there's a guy up there that is really obsessed with her. He's been obsessed with her as long as I've known her, which was when we were both 4 years old. That's right. And he's obsessed with her, and he really doesn't care that much about her. And he's obsessed with her. He loves to report back to me. And he's very conscious of her attitude. He said, did you notice the tone of voice in which she was just talking to you? Does she realize who she's married to? And if I get to listen to him, and I used to listen to him all the time, our relationship goes downhill. But there's another one up there just as obsessed with her, and thinks she's just terrific. Thinks she's got a great sense of humor, very spiritual, likes to remind me that she went to meetings when I didn't go, likes to point out that she's still going to Al-Anon after 29 years. My relationship with Max depends on who I listen to, not on what she does. And in fact, I find that's true with many things, that there's only one person up there that wants to see me drink. Only one. The rest don't want to see me make it. But whoever I listen to moves to the front of the room and talks the loudest. But I've learned, in fact, the things they say are, I'm glad you can't hear what I got to listen to. Because the things they suggest are illegal and lewd, and God, it would be very embarrassing if you had to listen to it. My life is driven by them, and now that I know they're there, I can listen to them and not fight them. The worst thing you can do is fight them, because they really love, that energizes them. Instead, I say, well, thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, I'll call on somebody else. And I have a meeting going on all the time in my head. That's part of why I have so much trouble. That's where my dysnomia comes from. I have dysnomia. That's why we wear, one of the reasons, that's why I'm happy that we wear badges. And it always annoys me when somebody's badge is turned around and they don't have one on. Because that's how I look down when I'm talking to you, because I have dysnomia. It's a form of dyslexia. Dyslexia is where you have trouble reading. And dysnomia is a form of dyslexia. Dysnomia is where you can't remember names and faces. And when I don't remember your name, I love you, but I just can't remember your name. And if you get resentful at me, you're wasting your time. You shouldn't think of me as being self-centered and selfish. You should think of me as being sick. Sick, self-centered, and selfish. I have dysnomia, and that's why I can't remember your name. I love you, but I can't remember your name. Anyhow, somebody was talking to me, too, Carol was asking about sponsorship. She's sober 2 years, and somebody asked her to sponsor, and she was asking me some thoughts on it. And, you know, I've talked to others about that. I think sponsorship should be fun. This program should be fun. Staying sober should be fun. You're supposed to enjoy it. And I think sponsorship should be fun. And my relationship with my sponsor is that I was sober a year or two or something like that, and I talked to this friend, Jack, and the home group was making fun of me because I didn't have a sponsor. I was complaining about Max, and they found out I didn't have a sponsor. And they got after me, and I was telling Jack how mean they were to me. And he was sober about a month or two longer than I was. And I said to him, I said, why don't you be my sponsor? And he said, well, I'll be your sponsor if you'll be my sponsor. And I said, well, I don't know if they allow that. It sounds kind of incestuous to me. But he's been doing it for 29 years, and he's such an accommodating guy. After about 3 months, he went out and had a one-night stand. and then came back. So now I'm a little ahead of him, which I thought was very accommodating of him. And but we sponsor each other. And we were talking about this the other day. And neither one of us can recall a time when either of us ordered the other to do anything. What we do is share. It's a sharing of, we know each other and we're close friends. And I think of sponsorship as needing a second opinion on every brilliant idea I have. I just need a second opinion. And often it's what he says when I express it, and other times it's what I come to realize when I'm even when I'm saying it. But I was thinking the other day that somebody had shown me a computer program. It makes charts, makes bar graphs and pie charts. I thought, wouldn't that be interesting if we had a computer big enough and had all the facts in a way that I could put them in the computer? What would a chart of my life look like? And I visualized it as though it would be that giant V that we see, like with recovering alcoholic, getting worse and then recovering. My life started way, way over there, and it was on a downhill course until July 31st, 1967. And it's been getting better and better ever since. And what happened, it wasn't a straight line down, it was up and down, just enough ups to keep me thoroughly confused. But when it went down, it was downer than it was the last time it went down. It ended up in the nut ward. And that wasn't bad enough, I had to go to AA. And after 7 months of AA, I turned into a very mild, accidental alcoholic. And my life's been getting better and better and better and better ever since. Again, not in a straight line, up and down, up and down. But it's better than it's ever been. And as far as I said, as far as I know, as I said earlier, there seems to, the only limit as to how high that can go, it seems to me, is how long I can stay around here doing the things I'm doing that's keeping it on an uphill curve. And even when it does have a down dip, there are a lot of things I can do. Go to more meetings, read the book, call my sponsor, work with another alcoholic, pray, all that stuff. And I, and even if I don't do anything, I know it's going to get better. I mean, it's just, sometimes you just sit still and wait. And it's like Winnie Eddy from deceased Al-Anon, one of the favorite Al-Anon speakers, used to say, it's her only Bible quote, that when things get bad, she said the only Bible quote she ever used was, the Bible says, and it came to pass. The Bible doesn't say, and it came to stay. So, you know it's going to get better if you just wait it out and watch it go on up. And what fascinates me, though, is the point of that V. That on July 31st, 1967, I accepted the fact that I, of all people, strange as it might seem, and even though I had no choice in the matter, I was a mild alcoholic. And of course, the thing is that then I had to go to AA meetings to stay sober, and the more meetings I went to, the more I kept getting reinfected, so I'm much, 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 much more alcoholic now than I was then. In fact, I even developed a bit of a pill problem along the way. Well, nothing serious, though. I never became an addict or anything like that. No, I didn't. I never, ever took a pill unless I had the precise symptom that only that pill would take care of. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time, prescribed by a doctor, and taken according to directions. My own. Yeah. I took a few narcotics. I wasn't an addict, because addicts, they'll take anything. What's that? Give me some. I'll squirt it in and see what happens. None of that. That's not... Listen, I never used anything but the purest of drugs and was very careful about them. I remember talking the other day, a guy was wasting Demerol. wasting Demerol. Now, Demerol is a potent, beautiful narcotic drug. Should be treated with respect and used appropriately. And he was injecting it in the muscle. You never inject Demerol in the muscle. You put it in the vein, for heaven's sake. You can't use morphine or Dilaudid. In fact, you have to practice medicine with one hand if you use morphine and Demerol. Makes my nose itch just to think of it. Ooh, ooh. Makes a nose itch. And it's hard to practice medicine when you're on morphine and Demerol, because you have to do anything with one hand. And besides, it always made me vomit unpredictably. Patients never got used to that. Incidentally, this is an AA meeting tonight, but the meeting is, in my opinion, this is strictly my own opinion, happens to be right too, but it's just my opinion. These meetings here over this weekend, or this week, are what you might call generic AA meetings. You know, almost anything goes. Everybody's welcome here, and everybody's welcome to talk about whatever they have. In fact, let's see the hands of the alcoholics. Would you raise your hands? All the alcoholics. Okay, now put your hands down. How about people who belong to organizations other than maybe just AA? What other organizations? Look, a lot of them. So you're as much at home here as the alcoholics are. What about people who are at their first sober Club Med? Would you raise your hand? Look, there's a lot of them. You know, one of the things that really impresses me so much about recovering alcoholics in a group like this, we hear a lot about, in the Serenity Prayer, we said it earlier here, acceptance. But we don't hear much about courage to change. And it really impresses me that the courage it takes for people to come to a thing like this for the first time. That's scary. I mean, my whole life was based on the idea I wouldn't do anything until I knew what my escape route was going to be, who's going to be there, what's going to happen, and all that stuff. And I'm sure it's very frightening. And so you saw the hands of people that are here for the new first time. They need to be supported and need comfort and to be. So let's look out for each other and have a real good time. I'd like to see all meetings start and end with the hugging. I'd like to see the hugging be so much a part of this week that your biggest problem will be when you leave here, you'll find yourself hugging people in the restroom of the airport when you leave. Somehow they'll help you break that habit out there. But I understand that Steve and Guy want to have some announcements, and the Super Bowl starts certainly after that. And so I don't. That's right. Some other non-sports person picked that up. Anyway, I'm just delighted to be here, and I intend to have a good time. And by God, if you don't, it's your own damn fault. Thank you very much.